Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What? I'm your host, Tom Kearns, and welcome to the Anglo-Saxon England podcast, episode 53, Pagan Reaction. A common feature of early Anglo-Saxon history, at least as presented by Bede, is what is called pagan reaction. Since Bede was writing an ecclesiastical history, that is, a history of the church, reactions against the spread of Christianity, of course, greatly disturbed him. Usually, these reactions took the forms of kings who aggressively reversed the policies of their Christian predecessors by ending royal patronage of the church in favour of support for traditional practitioners of pagan religiosity. Often these reactions were popular among the populace, who took the opportunity to seize church lands and expel, sometimes even kill, priests and monks. While such reactions almost certainly were motivated by more than just religious dissatisfaction, Bede, possibly not wishing to cast any positive light on them, doesn't mention this. We're thus forced to read between the lines of his account, which presents him as mainly motivated by pagan error. As discussed in the last episode, Radwald was not a committed Christian. It seems that he supported and even engaged in both Christian and pagan worship within his household, something which is unusual by our standards and was unusual by the standards of the time, but which made sense within a polytheistic worldview. His son Eöpwald was, at the time of his accession in 624, still resolutely pagan, indicating that Radwald didn't enforce a Christian conversion upon his family. Some scholars suggest that at the accession of Eöpwald, the Christian faction in East Anglia was beginning to resent not wielding as much influence as Christians elsewhere. They could look, for example, to Edwin's Northumbria to see a powerful king who used that power to support and expand the church. How Eöpwald responded to this is unclear, but it seems that he tried to maintain peace while remaining pagan himself. This changed, though, in 627, when Edwin, now the most powerful king in England, undertook to convert his own people, as well as those of Lindsay and East Anglia, areas over which he seemingly exerted influence as an overlord. Bede claims that through Edwin's influence, Eöpwald was convinced to become a Christian. How true this is remains impossible to say, since Bede is the only source we have for the event. However, in 627, in a reverse of the relationship that had existed between Edwin and his father, Eöpwald undertook the formal process of becoming a Christian and reputedly received a baptism, most likely with Edwin as his sponsor. With Eöpwald now formally a Christian, he was charged with the task of spreading the faith among his people. However, shortly after his baptism, Eöpwald was murdered by a pagan noble named Ricbert, who then seized the throne of East Anglia for himself. This sudden turn of events leaves the sincerity of Eöpwald's conversion open to debate, since he didn't have the opportunity to back up his baptism with actions. Bede may be correct when he claims that Edwin convinced Eöpwald, but it would be foolish to ignore the fact that Edwin was at this point the most powerful king in England. I've already discussed in previous episodes how baptism and conversion rapidly became a tool of overlordship and power, since they inherently situated a recipient as subordinate to the ruler who provided or enforced them. We cannot ignore the fact, then, that in 627, Eöpwald had become subordinate to Edwin, thus acknowledging the Northumbrian as his overlord. Seen in this light, Ricbert's murder of the king may have been about more than just religious differences. Rick Barrett may well have represented a faction of the East Anglian nobility unhappy with taking a subordinate role to the Northumbrians. In this context, Christianity may well have become a political issue, but it would be misleading to suggest that it was the only cause for Eorpwald's murder. Nevertheless, the killing of Eorpwald provided the Anglo-Saxon Church with its first martyr, since the king is the first person in England recorded to have been killed for his Christianity. There's a lot of later myth-making here, especially since we don't really know that much about Eorpwald or the nature of his conversion, but the image of Eorpwald as a martyr and then later as a saint did survive into the early 20th century. Today, though, he is largely forgotten, never having been officially canonised by any church. But he nevertheless is an interesting footnote in the history of English Christianity, even if his own Christianity must forever remain somewhat suspect. After Eorpwald's murder, Rick Barrett may have become King of East Anglia. It's not 100% clear that he did. Bede doesn't explicitly claim that he did. His only mention of Rick Barrett is in his reference to Eorpwald's murder, and besides this, he merely says that East Anglia remained in error, i.e. pagan, for 3 years after Eorpwald's murder. If Rick Barrett became king then, his rule left no definite mark in the literary or archaeological evidence. He is one of the names sometimes floated for the man buried in Sutton Hoo ship burial, alongside Radwald and Eorpwald himself. But if the image of him as a pagan reactionary is accurate, then it seems difficult to reconcile this with the hybrid pagan-Christian materials found in the grave. If, for the sake of argument, the man buried there is Rick Barrett, though, his burial at Sutton Hoo would reflect a remarkable assertion of legitimacy, since that burial site was the traditional cemetery of the Wuffingas dynasty. Rick Barrett's imposing himself on it would suggest that either he was a Wuffing himself, or that he sought to bind himself with East Anglia's legitimate royal dynasty, perhaps indicating some anxiety that he wasn't seen as truly legitimate in life. Hi listeners, I wanted to take a second to tell you about the sponsor of today's episode, Factor. Eating better is easy with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, restaurant-quality, and dietitian-approved, and it's all ready to go in 2 minutes with minimal meal prep. I've had some fantastic meals like butter chicken and tomato risotto with Factor, and I've got to say, I've been extremely impressed with all of them. They genuinely are restaurant quality. You'll get over 35 different options to choose from every week if you try out Factor, including Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, and Keto. Also, with pancakes, smoothies, and more, there's over 60 add-ons to help you stay fueled up and ready to go throughout the day. Factor also works around your schedule. You can order as little or as much as you need each week, and they even let you reschedule deliveries any time of when those unexpected somethings happen to pop up. And to top it all off, Factor is cheaper than ordering takeout, so it really is a smart move to try it out. Get started today and get after your goals. If you're interested in trying Factor, head to factormeals.com/anglo50 and use code anglo50 to get 50% off. That's code anglo50 at factormeals.com/anglo50 to get 50% off.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words, a podcast that presents the unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. As a country, we need these stories more than ever. Stories from Americans who have borne the battle, including 30-year-old remastered interviews with veterans from World War I recounting their time in the trenches of Europe, and with veterans from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and from our most recent conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other battlefields Americans may never have heard of. Hear their stories by listening to Warriors in Their Own Words wherever you find podcasts.
Welcome to Anthology of Heroes, the podcast that explores the most pivotal moments of history through the eyes of those who lived it. In this podcast, we don't spend our time recounting facts and dates. Instead, we follow in the footsteps of national heroes, kings, or ordinary people who lived and breathed the moments that shaped our world. We're not hemmed in by eras, borders, or religions. Instead, we seek out the tales of those who defied the odds and fought passionately for their beliefs. Whether they're right or wrong is up to you to decide. From Vercingetorix's doomed rebellion against Rome, to Osceola's unshakable war against the USA, all the way up to the inspiring Sobibor concentration camp uprising in World War II, each episode is an immersive listening experience, blending music and sound effects to really draw you into the story. Our episodes go for about 45 minutes, making them perfect for your commute, and are crafted using a wealth of historical sources, which I list on our website if you want to learn more. I'm the host, Elliot Gates, and I'm thrilled to have you joining me as we uncover history's hidden gems and illuminate the faded pages of our past. Look out for the Anthology of Heroes podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, or anywhere else you get your podcasts from.
Hello, listeners. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I just wanted to let you know that if you enjoy what I'm doing here, then it really helps me when you leave a review or a rating on the podcast provider you're using to listen to this, when you subscribe to the show's YouTube channel, or even when you become a supporter over on Patreon, where you can get access to bonus episodes, ad-free episodes, and transcripts by pledging to one of the show's patron tiers. And speaking of patrons, I wanted to give a shout out to Jeff Hamilton, who recently became a patron. Thank you so much for your support, and I hope that you're enjoying the extra material you now have access to. Anyway, back to the show. The 3 years of error associated with Ricbert came to an end in 630, when two new kings appear on the historical scene. Siebert, son or possibly stepson of Radwald, and Edrich, who is said to have been Siebert's kinsman, but exactly how isn't clear. Siebert was a Christian in 630, and he applied his newfound power to the task of converting the East Anglians. With the help of a Burgundian priest named Felix, Siebert established the first bishopric in East Anglia in a place called Domock, the location of which is now lost, but which was probably in Suffolk. With this Felix, he also established the first school in East Anglia for the express purpose of teaching boys Latin so that they could eventually become priests themselves. By establishing a bishopric and a school then, Siebert was effectively establishing Christian infrastructure in East Anglia, something that hadn't existed up until that point, which would have made formally converting the kingdom and the populace extremely difficult. If you'll think back to the Northumbrian series, a theme that came up in that was the difference between the Canterbury or the Roman style of ecclesiastical practice and the Irish style of ecclesiastical practice, both of which circulated in early Anglo-Saxon England, and which, in the early 7th century, began to become increasingly hostile towards each other, ultimately culminating in the Synod of Whitby, at which it was agreed that the English Church would follow Roman custom. Siebert, in his conversion of East Anglia, seems to have cultivated both the Roman and the Irish styles of Christianity. We can say this because, in addition to Felix, who, being from the continent, was firmly wedded to the Roman style of ecclesiastical practice, Siebert also welcomed a group of Irish monks, led by Fursey, who later became a saint, to establish themselves in a monastery near a Roman fort called Knobheresburg, in Old English, which today is probably the village of Burcastle near Greater Yarmouth in Norfolk. This royal patronage of both Felix and Fursey indicates that in East Anglia, then, we see a very rare instance of peaceful coexistence between the Roman and the Irish styles of Christianity that would later become overtly hostile, but which for now, probably united by a common missionary aim, were able to put their differences aside. The image of Siebert that prevails in the historical literature is one of an intensely pious king. That is certainly the image that was promoted by Bede, who has really nothing but glowing praise for Siebert. Edrich, on the other hand, may well have not been a Christian at all. Bede never alludes to his baptism or to his participating in the missionary activities of his kinsmen. Certainly he was not openly opposed to these, probably because he functioned more as a sub-king to Siebert than a true equal. But Edrich's religious convictions remain deeply mysterious. If he was pagan, clearly he was not militant about it, probably indicating that a lot of pagans in East Anglia were similarly fairly unconcerned about the spread of the new religion. Since he was a kinsman of Siebert, it is entirely possible that he was willing to tolerate his kinsman's religious feelings and missions so long as his dynasty remained on the throne. What is not mysterious about Edrych is the bind he was left in when Siebert chose to abdicate the throne to become a monk in the monastery that would later become the Abbey of Bury St. Edmunds. The precise date of this abdication is unknown, but it cannot have come at a good time, since in 633, Edwin, the East Anglians' staunch ally, was killed by Pender of Mercia and Cadwallon ap Cadfan, leaving all of England south of the Humber exposed to Mercian aggression. After regrouping following their success in Northumbria, in 636 the Mercians launched an invasion of an East Anglia that at this time was certainly being ruled only by Edrych. Despite amassing a mighty army to resist the Mercians, Edrych still knew that he was outnumbered and needed something more to inspire his men. He recalled the affection with which Siebert was viewed by his people, and so sent a messenger to the former king pleading for him to leave his monastery and lead the army. Siebert, totally focused on his religious life, refused. In response, the messengers, overcome with panic and desperation, seized the former king and forcibly dragged him out of the monastery, taking him all the way to the battlefield. There, the monk refused to take up any weapons or to fight in the coming battle. Opting to keep Siebert there as a symbol, even if he wouldn't actually do any fighting, Edrych chose to meet the Mercians on the battlefield. In the ensuing bloodshed, the defenceless Siebert was killed, as was Edrych himself. The broken East Anglians then fled the field and left the Mercians to ravage the kingdom unopposed. From this point on, East Anglia was permanently eclipsed by its more powerful neighbours in the west and the south. It remained independent, though, and continued to exist into the 9th century, as I'll discuss in upcoming episodes, but it never again achieved the same level of influence that it had in the early 600s under the leadership of Radwald. Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Anglo-Saxon England podcast. Once again, I've been your host, Tom Kearns, and I hope you'll join me again next time.
Around 10,000 BCE, families and tribes of the ancestors to the people of Britain would arrive in the southern part of the island after crossing from land that bridged from Europe. The Welsh built houses, communities, kingdoms, and continued to survive through Romans, Saxons, Danes, and Normans. The language and culture influenced by these sources continued to change and thrive, becoming ancient and modern at the same time. Join me as we travel through the history, meeting the kings, queens, nobles, and everyday people that create and grew modern Wales from the seeds of the ancient past. Creoso, and welcome to the Welsh History Podcast.